How did she die? What day?
We can estimate general happenings from these images. But I can't trace down precise actions at exact moments, Captain. I'm sorry.
Spock. I believe I'm in love with Edith Keeler.
Jim, Edith Keeler must die.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton. Actually, not really. It's Ryler Rorton, his long-lost twin double, Cam. How's that for a plot twist?
Who's actually a Stargate fan, not a Star Trek fan.
If I had a double, would my name really be Ryler Rorton?
I would hope so. I would hope not.
Okay. Actually, I think that was maybe a Freudian slip. You almost said, I would hope so.
I know.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could be Sam Kith.
Okay, so Sam, so what is our conundrum this week?
This week, we're going to talk about Star Trek's biggest twists.
Yeah, I think we need to kind of define that. And people might have different interpretations of what a twist means, you know? I would not consider Wesley showing up in Parallels as a plot twist or a character twist or anything like that.
Well, I better just scratch that off my number one biggest twist.
Yeah, because that's really more kind of like a surprise.
Sure.
You know, I think when it comes to a twist, maybe the way that I'll define it, though, is it causes me as a viewer to redefine my past interpretations of the narrative and what had come before that.
Sure.
So, well, I think we can kick it off with our first examples here. But do you have a specific definition in mind?
Mine's along those same lines as you. I think also there's a lot of debate. This is kind of an ongoing thing, and I read a lot in film criticism of the difference between a twist and a reveal.
Yeah.
And for me, I think it has to do more with like a plot twist is really going to deal with the surprise, as you say, or that shift in the narrative where it is actually going to explore that. Whereas a reveal is often just kind of that surprise at the end or something. Like, for example, the Traveler showing up, you know, at the end of Journey's End. You're kind of just like, oh, okay. Just like a quick surprise. It doesn't spend time dealing with the ramifications of that, really.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a way to, you know, cap off the episode.
Again, more kind of like a surprise versus something that's going to cause you to really redefine everything that had come before.
And it doesn't shift the narrative.
Yeah.
It doesn't kind of upset where you think you're going.
Well, we might have some debates about whether something constitutes a plot twist here or there. And I think that'll be actually fun because I'm sure there's going to be listeners thinking like, these idiots don't know what they're talking about here.
Right.
So if you and I can get into it, why don't we kick it off? Cam, what's your first plot twist that you want to talk about here?
Okay, well, let's...
One of Star Trek's biggest. Don't start with a small plot twist, Cam. Don't talk about, don't give me more Kazon talk or anything like that.
In the episode Shades of Grey. No, let's talk about one.
Plot twist, Star Trek sucks.
Says Ryler Orton, Stargate fan.
Yes.
Let's talk about Edith Keeler in City on the Edge of Forever.
Okay.
Which is a case where, you know, we meet this Edith Keeler character. We think we're getting some sort of romance and surprise. Kirk and crew have to somehow fix the narrative timeline. And she has to die.
Yeah, essentially, otherwise, Nazi Germany would rule across the land, you know?
Doesn't that feel like such an old-timey kind of twist?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
It also makes it a very Earth-centric series that Star Trek often likes to do. Like, one person, the fate of the entire history of mankind rests on this one person, whether it's Edith Keeler or Gabriel Bell or what
sure.
have you.
Yeah. So what did you think of this one when the first time you saw this episode?
Well, of course, it's tragic, though, you know, because there's definitely... And I think the reason like, this is such a big twist, though, is because you actually have emotional investment in this character. And I think that is...
They do a good job tricking you with, especially the tropes of a TV show in the 60s, where you would have not just Star Trek, but other shows. You would have kind of that romantic interest of the week. And it rarely ended with that character having to die. They might die through circumstance, but not like this.
Do you think something like this going on in this era of the original series. It may have only come from the pen of Harlan Ellison, who is really somebody who's out there trying to subvert expectations when it came to science fiction writing.
Yeah, and even far more so than Star Trek would even allow, because his initial script was much more different than the final show, but that twist is intact.
Yeah. So for you, I don't know, are we going to do a warp scale of biggest twists? We've done that in the past.
Yeah, we can do that. That's fun.
Okay. Where would you put this on a warp scale of twists?
This one is such a huge advantage for being so early in the franchise. Okay. And taking real risks at a time where a lot of, you know, hour-long TV shows didn't. So, like, I think this might be like a 9 for me.
Warp 9. Okay. Yeah. So we're getting almost to Salamander Paris sort of levels, but not quite onto the warp 10 threshold at this
the
point.
The legacy on this one is too strong to really push it aside. Yeah. What about you?
I'll give it a warp 8. A good solid warp 8, because I think only in retrospect, it looks somewhat conventional. Mm-hmm. It's just like, oh yes, of course, all of the fate of mankind rests on this one woman's shoulders. But you know what? I think as you watch it in a vacuum and as you are interpreting this, it's really great. It's great drama there.
And Joan Collins adds so much to that twist herself.
Yeah.
Just imbuing that character with so many qualities. You don't want to see anything bad happen to that character. Yeah.
So next big twist we have to discuss is how the dog is really the villain in Aquiel. No, I'm
going to... Holy smokes. I didn't even write that one down. That's glorious.
No. I'm not... We can skip over... That's a warp...
That's a 10.
That's a warp 10. Okay. That's Salamander Paris right there. No. This is a fun one. This is one that really did cause me to rethink what had happened in prior episodes when the big reveal that... Bashir's actually been occupied by a changeling persona for the last few episodes here because, of course, in that Deep Space Nine two-parter, by Inferno's Light, I believe, it's revealed that he's in his pre-First Contact uniform, whereas everyone else is in their First Contact uniforms on this prison camp here.
Yes.
And we find out that changeling Bashir has been performing brain surgery on Sisko in the episode Rapture. He also delivered Kira Yoshi. You know, it's a very, very smart changeling with, you know, a full medical degree and all the experience that comes with it.
How do you think that went behind the scenes of the changelings setting up this imposter? Like, that's some, you know, brain surgery is not an easy, you know, read this book and you got it figured out kind of process.
I think, look, the changelings, they used to be solids, right?
Yeah.
So they've got that sort of institutional knowledge within them. And the changelings, like, the way that I have to think of it, they must be, what, like 100,000 years old, you know?
Right.
And just think about how you drop a drop into the pond and it becomes part of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever one learns over the course of their journeys, you know, everyone else absorbs through that. So I think it is very possible that they're quick to learn and quick to adapt to these kinds of situations. So they may have that medical knowledge. I don't know.
Maybe they also had that device from Spock's brain.
I'd appreciate that. For you, when you saw this, though, I mean, had this been spoiled for
you? No, it had not.
Okay.
No, I lived in a world where there was no such thing as Deep Space Nine spoilers in my life.
That's fair.
When I watched the show.
I guess it was only me who could have spoiled it for
you,
right? Yeah,
like the show had been off the air for a long time and no one I knew ever talked about the show, so it was the whole series was unspoiled for me, but no, like when this happened I was genuinely blown away. But it is like one in retrospect you're like, does it hold up? Like, I think it kind of does, but I think if they were to write it now you would have had maybe some subtle clues along the way that you could go back to and feel a little more rewarded over.
The writers had clearly made it up in the episode.
Yeah.
And look, there's some other Bashir stuff that we can maybe get into later on.
Yeah, there
but
is.
Like, I do kind of, I like that they were willing to take a chance like this, you know, because it makes you feel like you should be on your toes. And I think that's what a good plot twist does as well, you know. And like, who else down the line could possibly be a changeling infiltrator too?
Do you think they did a good job of paying it off after the fact with the actual Bashir acknowledging this fact?
No. Yeah. I mean, like, how long was he in that prison camp for? It must have been, like, at least 2 months, right?
The PTSD was very minor.
Yeah, he seemed pretty chill there. He's helping some Breen soldiers and, having a good old time there.
Yeah, chilling with Martok.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
How come they don't have, like, a closer relationship after
no
that time?
No kidding.
Yeah.
No kidding. Why wasn't this, like, Papillon or something where, like, they are bonded for life?
Well, Martok's bitter that the real Bashir could not save his eyeball. Like, that's where it stems from there. So
on a warp 10, what do you give this one?
You know, I got to go back to just my reaction when I found that out. I'm giving this a warp 9 right there. It was really, really cool. And we really had not seen a twist like that on Star Trek before, where it's something that stretches back into the history. And by history, I mean at least like 6-7 episodes. But it's just like, oh, wow, like that's crazy. And for me, what sold it was the uniform, though. It's like he had it, like it was just perfect timing for them to have him in a different uniform, though. So it didn't seem as if he had been there for like 4 years.
Right.
But it just long enough where it would have been uncomfortable for this fella.
Right. So. Yeah, I find the grading on this one a little difficult because, yeah, the actual, you know, reveal of what has happened is like amazing. But then I have to look at the previous episodes and the episodes after, and I'm like, well, they don't really deal with it. So, but I do like also that it is a little bit, you know, paying off the whole idea of like, there's the whole, you know, the changelings are everywhere.
Yeah.
And this is a really great example of it. And so I'm going to give it an 8. I think the moment is amazing. I just wish they'd given us a little more, maybe after, a little more before.
Okay. So we're both high on our plot twist so far.
Yeah.
What's next up for you, Cam?
Okay. Well, let's take on one that we've talked a lot about. So let's just get it out of the way. And that's the Lorca twist in Discovery.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I know what it's going to
be. We've done this one exhaustively.
Be on my warp scale. But so my issue with this is I saw it coming.
Yeah.
And the entire time I was wishing it wasn't true. I thought that they were going to be smarter than that and maybe subvert our expectations. I was hoping it was going to be a red herring. And I was just like, oh no, please don't do this. This is not a great twist. This actually makes the series all the worse.
Yeah, like I find it very frustrating because Lorca was a character that like I was really invested in, and that's fine. You can totally have a twist on a character that my investment still stays with the character, but the problem was everything leading up to it was far more interesting than everything that came after that.
Exactly.
Once he was revealed as the villain, we've said it before, you know, the mustache twirling villain, but like it was almost worse than that because you can watch a movie with like a mustache twirling villain who's like really magnetic and charismatic on screen, whereas like it felt like they didn't even write villain Lorca interesting things to do, really.
No, he actually seemed like kind of stupid.
Yeah, like the Riddler, this man was not. You know, he was not someone who was like a charismatic force on screen when he became a villain. It was like they just kind of made him like a thug who wasn't that bright.
And for those who may forget what our big complaint was, though, is because prior to this, like Lorca had been set up as a very complex, very gray sort of character who seemed to be motivated by very different things, in which I think what you could interpret is that the Klingon War was having a destructive impact on his psyche. And that's what was motivating what we thought was a prime Lorca. But then we find out, like, no, he's just a jerk because he's from a mirror universe and he's just evil for the sake of it. And what's motivating him? He wants to be emperor. He just wants to rule everything. Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh, this character's no longer interesting at all. Like, his motivation stinks now. And that's one of the key things for good drama is, like, what's motivating the character?
But also, I mean, they set up so much in the first half of that season or whatever, a little more than the first half of, like, this character being like this really strategic genius and all these sorts of things. He's obsessed with the Klingon War, and none of that stuff holds water after the fact, which is not the sign of a good twist.
I know.
You want to be able to go back and really be like, oh, wow, like I can see where this character is going moment to moment. And there's little bits here and there, but it's really superficial details. It's not the actual moment to moment actions of the character.
It's like, hey, look, people. He has problems with his eyesight.
Right.
They planned it all along. I'm like, I don't care that they planned it all along. I care that it made him a much less interesting character, you know? Like, the twist, the reveal, whatever you want to call it, it wasn't worth it to me.
We've just finished season 2 of Discovery not too long ago, and between the two seasons, you had these captains who came into the show and added a lot of energy. How much do you think the Lorca twist took away from sort of the lingering fondness for the Jason Isaacs character versus like Anson Mount coming off of season 2, where you don't have a twist with that character, but I feel like there's a real passion still for the character once the season ends.
Well, there's a reason why there's no campaigns for a Lorca spinoff at this point versus a Pike spinoff at
this point. And people do not seem to be that concerned or upset about the potential of maybe not even seeing a prime Lorca anymore.
Yeah, because it might be tough to make that happen outside of, say, a Section 31 spinoff.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think Jason Isaacs is a treasure. Like, I think he's a fantastic actor.
Yeah.
I'd love to see him appear again, especially if he's playing a good dude.
Mm-hmm.
I just hope they give him something interesting to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay, well, what do you give the Lorca twist on your warp scale then?
Cam, I'm going bold here. Warp 1. This is just like...
Warp 1! Holy smokes.
Well, there has to be... Sure. The worst twist ever. And for me, this constitutes the worst twist in Star Trek because it really soured me on a character I otherwise was interested and invested in. You know, so this I thought this was just really bad storytelling. That's why it's a warp one for me.
I'm going to give it a warp three.
Okay.
And the reason I give it a couple extra points is that when I do rewatch Discovery, it doesn't completely ruin my enjoyment of watching Lorca during those earlier episodes. Like, to me, personally, like a one has to... completely ruin it for me, where like I don't even want to rewatch those stories anymore, whereas I don't feel that way. The Lorca one's frustrating, but I don't sit through Contexts for Kings being like, screw this. So
yeah. All right, and maybe this is one where we can debate what constitutes a twist versus a reveal, but I really think that when it comes to Sela, it made me redefine in my head the fate of Tasha Yar. And so here I'm saying that the reveal of Sela as the kind of the puppet master who's been doing Manchurian candidate stuff and trying to instigate a Klingon civil war.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, wait a minute. Is that Denise Crosby? What is going on here? What like that was like, I think, like, not just a reveal, that is a twist to me, because you have a very familiar face and I think there are questions all about, and I think there's so much more potential for this character than what was ultimately realized on screen.
Yeah.
But it was still like a blast to try to kind of make sense of it all in your head here, though. And, you know, piecing it together through Yesterday's Enterprise parallel universe sort of thing, which, again, I don't think that would constitute a twist in that Tasha's back. I mean, that's an alt universe.
Sure.
But the fact that she still has to have a bit of a fate left over in the Prime universe, and then we get to see that on screen, I think that's kind of a cool thing here.
Yeah, it really is. It's just a frustrating one because they don't do that much interesting with it, but the buildup is really great. And, you know, I said off the top, this was the way I was able to kind of justify the Sela one as being a twist, because it is like a reveal, but the show then deals with that character. Like, it does shift the narrative of what you might have gotten, right? So that's how I kind of worked with it. But no, this was a really great legacy thing for Denise Crosby on the series, giving her that extra element of the show of intrigue. Just, there's a huge what if on this one. Like, oh my God, what if they just done something more? Because the buildup was so amazing.
And I think a lot of people have like a lot of nostalgia for her return. But for those that don't remember, like the last time we saw her, she was trying to get that plan going in unification with regards to having Romulan soldiers embedded on a planet Vulcan. She fails.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually kind of a dumb plan if you think about it too.
Yes.
And then nothing ever comes up.
They were embedded, Tyler.
They're embedded, Cam. Yeah. What was it, 3,000 soldiers?
I think it might have been 10,000, but
yeah. Taking over a planet of 9 billion? Okay. Sure.
Never doubt the Romulan forces, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. And Cam, have you heard those rumors that Denise Crosby's, I guess, stoking right now with a return of Sela in the Picard spinoff with one Empress Sela?
Sure.
What do you make of that?
I think it's... I don't want to say anything's unlikely now because we live in a world of fan service now.
Yeah.
But I have to believe, well, Picard is going to get a season two, unless there's some sort of unforeseen circumstances. We are getting a season two. And with season one, we're seeing Seven of Nine's back, Hugh is back, Data is in some form back. They are going to have some sort of fan servicey stuff in a season two. I guess the question is more, is Sela at the top of the list of things that interest them? The only thing I will say in favor of this, it looks like there's a very strong Romulan presence in season one. Mm-hmm. So that is a way.
Yeah. I'll say the way that I think it would not come off as silly is if the remainders of the Romulans, because we have to believe, even though we know Romulus is destroyed, there's Romulan colonies. They had an entire empire. There's lots of Romulans out there.
Yeah.
And I could totally imagine this Romulan Star Empire devolving into some interconnected planets, like alliances, you know, democratic. Mm-hmm. I could also see it devolving into disparate groups of maybe petty kingdoms, and maybe Sela is the one ruling over a couple of, like maybe a successor state of sort in some far off kind of colony or group of colonies. You know, like I could buy her as more of a petty queen than a great empress of an empire that she is trying to reignite once again. I think that it's actually more of an interesting thing, because where we left off Sela, she wasn't some great mastermind, and for her to somehow ascend to power,
yeah,
I don't know. But it is interesting. She's half human.
Yeah.
So that kind of brings in some interesting complexities there that I think they could have a lot of fun with if they did bring her back.
I would like to see her more of a supporting character than like a big bad or something like that. Like, it would be interesting to me if Sela was an outcast from Romulan society who Picard came across, and she shows up in an episode or two helping him along the way or something like that. Like, yeah. Don't make this a character that we're building up for like five episodes. She turns around in a big chair. You know, like, that's not the sort of thing I'm interested in.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually a good interpretation or a good pitch as well, because it shows that like it's not just Picard that's changed over the last few decades. Mm-hmm. Sela's changed as well. I think learning to fail is a great thing to do, and if she failed and learned from that, then boom, she could be a new sort of Sela character.
We do that every week.
Okay, so Cam, on the warp scale, I guess I give this a warp 6 ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm about with you there. I'm going to give it a 6 as well, because the reveal's great, but what do you get out of it?
I mean, you get a couple fun episodes.
I feel like the most interesting Sela stuff, though, is when she's in Shadows.
Yeah, and the Mind's Eye.
Yeah.
When we didn't know it was Sela.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of like, huh. But it is funny that if you watch it on Blu-ray now, you're like, oh, there's Sela. But I'm sure, like, at the time where, like, you're watching, like, essentially 480p, like, quality, it's just kind of like some blurry person with a voice that might be familiar. But also, I think it was great that there wasn't really all these like message boards where people could play Reddit detective and figure out, oh, no, that's obviously Denise Crosby. She's in this one, and have it all figured out before the end of the season where we had the Klingon Civil War get a going.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay, well, speaking of, you know, these surprise female adversaries, let's talk about Seska on Voyager.
Yeah, yeah, that was on my list too.
Yeah, where we have Seska get outed as a Cardassian that's been made over to look like a Bajoran, and she takes off and hooks up with the Kazon.
Yeah. When that happened, I was like, oh, that's pretty cool, because it actually made sense that the Cardassians had been actively infiltrating the Maquis.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it comes back to Voyager. Do they really, I don't know, cultivate as much as they can or should out of something like this that I think had a lot of potential? Because let's be honest, I think it would have been interesting if she was trying to get the Vidians on her side.
Right.
They're a far more intriguing species than the Kazon, but it kind of seemed as if she was punching it down a lot with like, she did not hide her disdain at how dumb these guys were.
No, no. And, you know, the thing that's interesting, too, is you get kind of another twist where she reveals she's impregnated with Chakotay's child. And I like that the show deals with that. Like, Chakotay has to really go through a character journey over this sort of thing, which is not something Chakotay does very often, is go through a character journey.
Yeah.
So you actually get good stuff.
Unless you count boxing.
That's a journey for all of us. Yeah. But yeah, like, I like that the twists with her are actually bringing things out of the characters as well.
Yeah. And you do get some plot stuff that ultimately does matter here when we get to the end. Mike Jonas is not the coolest character, but we get to have Neelix be detective as well.
That is a pretty lame twist, though.
but you also get to have an episode like Basics Parts 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty phenomenal Voyager two-parter.
Yeah, like the Seska finale is incredibly strong.
Yeah.
Yeah, like to me, the only thing that really hurts this one is just a lot of the Kazon stories aren't very interesting.
No.
The Seska like setup and reveal is really fantastic. The finale's really fantastic. And some of the stuff in between goes ups and downs.
So where do you put this on the warp scale, sir?
I'm going to give this one, I think, a 7.
Okay.
I think, like, I like it a lot, but as I said, a lot of the material kind of dealing with it is very hit or miss writing-wise.
I've got to... So if I'm giving Sela a warp 6, I don't know if I can give this one a warp 7, though, even though we ultimately get a great two-parter out of this. I give this a warp 6, too. I think this is on par with the Sela stuff. So
to me, this is like, the Sela stuff is a really great reveal, but then like, it's not dealt with well in the end, but whereas the Seska stuff is. So that's why I kind of give it an extra point higher.
Okay. I'm going to go give a little bit more attention to Deep Space Nine. It's been a few goes since we talked about that. But the Search Part 2, in which we find out that pretty much the entire episode is followed by Sisko, Bashir, Dax, what have you. It's all in their imagination. It's all part of like these dreams that the founders are using these machines to concoct kind of this sort of infiltration scenario on board the space station. For me, watching the episode a second time, knowing the twist, I feel a little bit less invested in what's going on here. But I remember the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, that's pretty cool, because the Kira, Odo and Salome Jen's character, the female changeling, they're all having kind of their own story independent of all that. And so I'm still invested in all that, which I think is great. This really made me redefine what had happened all before. You know, I thought that was pretty cool.
There's also some really great filmmaking and just having a really tense episode out of that, even if it is all a dream. Yeah. Like, I'm actually excited by what I'm seeing, even if it's not necessarily the second time through a huge surprise, although it was for me. I remember when we rewatched that one, I was like, what?
You forgot.
I totally forgot. But, so embarrassing.
To me, it seemed almost kind of like a classic Hollywood movie sort of thing. Like, hey guys, it's kind of a dream, you know, but it really actually showed how frightful the Dominion could be.
Yeah.
You know, like what they could do in terms of stoking paranoia, as well as just kind of their technological advantage that they have over our crew here, especially since it appeared, you know, you take the Defiant out once, mm-hmm. and the Dominion pretty much is capable of like rendering it like just a star wreck, very quickly, like that.
And then also like their methods of conflict are going to be very different than what we've seen before on Star Trek with, say, like the Borg or the Klingons.
Yeah,
it really does set them up really well as incredibly intelligent adversaries, which Star Trek hadn't really done a lot of. You'd say with the Romulans, for sure, but not so much. Like, well, not so much the Borg, for example.
Don't worry, in 6 months they would have introduced us to the Kazon, so.
Yeah. Star Trek's brainiest foes.
That's why their hair's so big. Warp scale? I give this a solid warp 7. Like, I thought this was, like, a good one.
Yeah. I would agree with, I think a 7 for sure. I think this one is really delivered well. And it's the sort of twist that, like, if you didn't do it well, it would be maddening to sit through.
And for me, it was a little maddening to sit through because I had remembered what the twist was. And so I was like, okay, you know, we're watching a dream. Interesting. The thing that you can argue, and I think you made this argument a couple months as well, is that you still get to see how characters react within a situation. If certain circumstances come up, you can see how our characters that we know are going to react to that, which I still think is valuable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so Cam, what's on your list now?
Well, I'm just going to go back to TOS for a second and talk about Devil in the Dark, which is one where we get the Horta introduced, which is a character that all these people are terrified of. And in the ultimate Star Trek twist ever, the one that really does pave the way for what this franchise is a lot of the time about, the Horta, we find out, is actually protecting its young.
Yeah.
And Spock bonds with it. And we get this, you know, this first contact between Spock and the Horta. And to me, like, this one is, again, really fantastic because at the time, 1966, there's a lot of, like, monster movies and monster stories. The idea of doing a twist on that and having the Horta be the most sympathetic character in the episode is, I think, really powerful.
See, I thought the most powerful thing was we find out even more how much mining colonies matter to the Star Trek lore. I thought this was a good one, though. Because it, again, makes you reinterpret everything that had happened before. Is this a malevolent being that is out there actively hunting people down?
Mm-hmm.
Nope. It's doing what any motherly figure would do when trying to protect its nest here. And I think, we can cap it off with the great mind melt stuff as well.
Sure.
I think that's like kind of a good solid outing. And I think it's really punctuated by something that again makes us reevaluate what had come before.
It also complicates the story because if it is a monster that's just killing people, how does that story end?
I know.
Right?
You destroy it.
Exactly.
You can predict it.
The second we understand that it's sympathetic, how do we deal with it then? That's where the complications come out of it, and that's where Star Trek is really interesting with these sorts of stories.
Yeah.
So what do you give this one on your warp 10?
I give it a warp 8.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm going to give this one a warp 9.
Okay.
I think this one, you know, it maybe loses something to a viewer now, But when you consider the fact this is season one that they're doing this sort of story, I think it's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. I'm going to go over to Enterprise. And here with the conclusion of the Kishara Vulcan arc, though we do find out that the planet Vulcan has been infiltrated, at least to some degree, by Romulan agents. And we had been wondering, like, what was the deal with this kind of jerky administrative sort of fella?
Yeah.
Well, it looks like it's unclear whether he is an actual Romulan or if he is just a Vulcan working on behalf of the Romulans. To me, it made me reevaluate kind of the buildup towards all the hints towards kind of a Romulan showdown that we would be getting. Of course, the Romulans and even the Remans did appear Star Trek Enterprise, which is cool. But man, it hurts me in only that, like, we could have thought of season five of Enterprise and, oh, what would have been,
right?
You know, like that's kind of a bummer there. But I love this. I just wish that they had been able to bring this to full fruition, though, with like these all-out Romulan storylines here.
Are Romulans the best characters for twists? Because it sure does seem like a lot of the time that's the way it works on Star Trek. Is like Romulans, because they're known as kind of a deceptive, group, the stories often are like these stories of deceit where things get a twist on it.
Even going back to their introduction, though, like nobody had ever seen a Romulan before. Yeah. At least no human had seen a Romulan face-to-face before. And boom, you find out that they're pretty much cousin species of the Vulcans. So
yeah.
That was fascinating.
I mean, also on Enterprise, you have the drone ship where, you know, they're trying to break into the cockpit the whole time. Then we find out it's being steered from Romulus.
Yeah, yeah.
So you get these great ones. And this is a really good example of as well. And I like that it adds depth to this whole Romulan-Vulcan, conflict between the two races. And it does it in a really exciting way and with a twist that you kind of go like, huh, wow.
For me, I've got to give it a warp 7, and like if we had gotten like a season 5 of Enterprise, I'm sure this would have been more like warp 8 for me.
Sure.
But it's just like, okay, there's a twist, but we never really get to act on it, though. And like that's kind of the bummer for me, because I think a lot of these twists, okay, maybe you can reinterpret what had gone before, but what comes after that? And you had pointed out that was maybe kind of one of the issues with the Bashir twist as well.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, this one... I think I agree. I think I'm going to go with a 7. I would almost be tempted to go a little higher, just for the fact that it actually does add some really interesting things to the mythology of those species that I can then wrap into my brain looking at future series. So it has that going for it. But I think ultimately I have to also say it's not like a big sexy twist that is one that stands at the forefront of people's minds when they think of Star Trek twists. So I think a 7 is a good number for it.
Okay. What's up?
Okay, well, let's go back to Discovery and take on another one.
Do I know which one you're going to say?
Let's just do the Ash Tyler Volk thing again.
I know. Okay. This one was stupid, right?
Yeah, I mean, we all knew that something was up with Ash Tyler because this character was so blank.
Yep.
And I just remember us commenting a lot like, boy, it's been a while since we've seen Volk on this show. This is really weird. And
because we loved Volk.
Yeah, we
did. He was a great character.
And we have to admit, the reveal, the actual scene revealing Volk to be Ash Tyler was fantastic. Like, and everything.
The showdown between Tyler and Burnham was, I think, one of the best scenes, if not the best scene in season one of Discovery.
And even the moment where he snaps in the scene in the Mirror Universe is really fantastic, too. So, like, the end game is pretty strong, but was it... I don't know. Was it too dragged out?
It's a fundamental problem that afflicts way too many movies and TV shows. When the audience is ahead of all the characters, it gets very frustrating for the audience to watch what's going down here. And in this case, like I said, those Reddit detectives, they solved it within one episode.
Yeah.
And you and I, we don't seek out spoilers at all.
Yeah.
But we couldn't avoid this. It just kept popping up. This theory kept popping up everywhere. And the more we thought about it, the more we dreaded it, because like, oh, this only makes sense. Like, this is where they're going. You know,
it didn't make sense why Volk left at the end of episode 4 and then was just never mentioned.
Yep.
You know, it was all just like, oh, yeah. And then remember Laurel showed up in the next episode and we didn't even realize it was Laurel the first time we saw that episode.
Well, do you think that this would have worked if it just wasn't a twist? If we are actually following Volk's journey, we knew that it was Volk. I think it would have added tension to the series because we could have questioned what, like, is this kind of a character who is a sleeper agent? Is he self-aware of being Volk at this point? Like, I think that would have been far more interesting for us to question in those ensuing weeks, as opposed to just saying, like, yeah, it's been 9 episodes since we saw Volk.
Yeah, and also...
Who's built up into such a huge character in those first three or four episodes.
If we'd followed Voke, do you lose that intended surprise? Yes, but I also think it makes the show more interesting on rewatch.
Yes.
Versus now, you're kind of just waiting out the Ash Tyler stuff.
And I think you still would have gotten that great scene between Burnham and Tyler. Like, yeah. That was a highlight for us from that season, and that would not have taken anything away.
There's also the problem for me, and that this one runs into a bit of a problem, in that I never really buy Ash Tyler as Voke. He never feels like the same character to me.
I can stomach it because he's not supposed to be.
Yeah. There is a division in my brain when I think of those two characters that's quite strong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it just, I don't know. It doesn't.
Those Klingon surgeons were really good at their job, Cam. Like,
it's kind of like the species 8472 showing up in the flesh, where they're like Starfleet characters.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I know I'm supposed to accept that these are members of species 8472, but the two things are not aligning in my brain.
And they really do have the nuances of the English language down, yeah, like cold. So it's, yeah, just like, okay.
Yeah. And Ash Tyler kind of had that going too.
Yeah. You know, well, look at those memoriamgrams. I don't know. Hand it to those Klingon spy masters. They kept at it with one Arn Darvin. So
yeah,
props to them.
For sure.
For me... I don't know, what frustrated more, this or Lorca? Lorca did. So okay. I'm going to give this a warp 3. It was frustrating for us to watch this week to week over the course of months,
mm-hmm,
knowing what the twist was. And it was just for us like a countdown saying like, when are they finally going to get around to revealing it? I don't know. This is just dragging it out more and more.
This one for me, this might be a 2 for me.
Okay.
Because when I think about what I like about it, there's very little. There's moments. Like, there is the reveal, you know, in the Wolf Inside episode. There's the stuff where they're gambling and he's kind of going all Klingon in the finale. But there's not a lot. And it's not like it led to a lot of fascinating Ash Tyler stuff in season 2 either.
Yeah.
The Lorca stuff, at least they had the courtesy to just write the character out, and we kind of dealt with the twist and moved on.
Yeah.
Whereas the Ash Tyler one still plagued us. And, like, look, he had some highs in season 2, but he had a lot of moments where we were like, why is this character being written in?
It just made it all the more frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to Voyager here with the Course Oblivion twist.
I had that one written down, too. That's great.
Well, here we are seemingly following the crew on their way home. We watch Tom and Valana get married, and then we find out, no, these are all like doubles that have been journeying for about a year and a half at this point, because it goes back to, I'm going to mess up the episode title here, because I keep getting, is it Demon? It's not Demons, right?
Right.
Demons is the Enterprise episode.
Correct, yeah.
Demon is the Voyager episode, which is a little tricky. But essentially, they had landed on that planet, and they were able to create doubles, and they kind of left them on that planet,
mm-hmm,
and which is fine, you know. And little did we know that we were actually going to follow these people on a journey, and they were never going to tell us it's their doubles. And I thought that was kind of genius.
Yeah, especially for an episode that kind of sucked.
Yes.
Demon is not very good.
No, it's rather boring.
Yeah.
Course Oblivion is actually a kind of a fun, exciting adventure.
It's a pretty great episode.
It's also very dark and depressing.
Yeah.
You know, but to me, it's a quintessentially Brian Fuller sort of episode, though, where like, mm-hmm, you kind of see him picking up like little threads that could work or had some potential, even in an episode as crappy as Fury.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he's bringing back the Vidians and having a Kes deliver her former crew members to the Vidians, like,
yeah,
it's very dark, but it's just like, okay, like there's some cool things that this writer, like, you just know it's coming from him.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good twist. This is everything a twist is supposed to be, because I didn't see it coming at all, you know?
And it does have that real Star Trek spirit to it as well, where you have like them deciding to uphold like the Starfleet values, because they still have that kind of that imprint of the original, you know, their original source material.
Yeah. And then it was so horrible when like the original Voyager crew came across them, and they just were like a puddle of like liquid in space. And
it's by minutes, too. It's like they're just like coming through, and then boom, they're gone.
And Janeway's like, oh, well, there you go. What was that? I don't know.
Yeah.
Oops. See ya.
It feels almost like a really dark joke.
It is.
Yeah. And I really like, and I wouldn't be surprised if it is a dark joke, because Brian Fuller has, I think, a bit of a penchant for that sort of thing.
Yeah. To me, this is not something that we had to worry about Reddit detectives over the course of weeks. This is what you're supposed to do. I give this a warp 8 here.
Yeah. I'm going to give this a warp 8 as well. Like, the thing about it is, it doesn't have the ramifications on the franchise that some of the ones we've sure. looked at in the past. But in terms of a conceived solo episode twist, it's pretty great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I want to talk about one where it also involves the Romulans. And it's a TNG episode. And it's Future Imperfect.
Okay.
Where Riker snaps to, and it's like 16 years in the future. And he's like the captain of the Enterprise. He has a child who likes dressing up in really scary costumes and sneaking up on him.
a child named Jean-Luc.
Yes.
Yeah.
It seems like this may be a Romulan plot, and I think all of the viewers, they're playing with the expectations here, where, of course, the Romulans are behind this. Who would... Tomalak, of course. But ultimately, Tyler, who is it?
It's like this little alien orphan boy that like looks like he was from like the Area 51 autopsy like bloopers or something.
Jonathan Frakes.
There you go. Yeah. And but essentially, yeah, he just wants a friend. He wants somebody to hang out with, and so he's gonna trap Riker in there through kind of a mystery box within a mystery box sort of deal. I'm not using the term mystery box correctly in this situation, but essentially, sure. like it's almost kind of a Moriarty situation. Like, where does a holodeck projection end? And where does reality begin, which is cool.
Yes, and of course, you know, this insectoid kid goes off with Riker at the end, the Enterprise, and...
We never hear from him ever again.
No, well, you know, he joined another ship. I'm sure he's fine.
Okay, yeah.
But, you know, I guess the question is, which twist do you go for? Like, because this one
has so many.
Yeah, this one has multiple twists, and the fact that they all work is a real testament to the writing on this episode.
Well, for me, I have to give this, like, you know, this episode... surprised me throughout.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't given away enough warp nines at this point. The fact that it kept making me reinterpret what I had seen just before, I think that's what you're supposed to do with these plot twists. I'm going to give this a warp nine here.
I think I might go with a 10 on this
one. Wow.
And
Transwarp Tom.
That's right. I guess, you know, when you look at this one, it pulls off multiple twists. Every one of them is like jaw-dropping, but also entirely believable. Like, there's never that moment, say, like, you know, with a Lorca one where you go like, well, hold on a second.
Yeah.
Like, they all would be compelling if they just stuck with that one twist. Like, that would be fascinating. And the fact they've got multiple to play off of is this episode is like a high wire act.
Okay. Well, Cam, I'm going to go back to Deep Space Nine once more. And yet again, I'm going to go into that Bashir well, because of course we find out that he's been genetically modified. And again, it makes you reinterpret what had come before. But the deal is, again, the writers had kind of made it up.
Sure.
You know, which is fine because you get a good episode out of it. And they actually do, unlike what they did with maybe the Changeling Bashir stuff, it actually has an impact on what's coming next for the character.
Yeah.
Stig Elfadil, like, infamously hated this twist.
Right.
Like, he really, really fought against it because he thought it kind of ruined how he had played the character in the preceding years, you know, and which is unfortunate because I actually thought it could have explained a lot of things. And there's some stuff that just doesn't make sense. Like, remember that episode where he turned 30 and...
Yeah, I do not like that episode.
Yeah, I can't believe I'm blanking on the name. I'm usually good with episode titles, but he gets shocked by that, like, that Nero... alien, and he is just like living life on a station and getting older and older very quickly. But that's one of my guilty pleasures there. But that one doesn't make sense because that's not one of the demons that comes back to haunt him, you know. But it has implications for his parents, their decisions in life. He's working with other people where their genetic modifications didn't go so well, and you know, like, I think this is kind of an important one for him.
Yeah, it's an interesting one to really think about in terms of, like, grading a twist, because the actual, like, reveal isn't as, like, exciting as, say, the Changeling Bashir. Like, that is a jaw-dropping, holy smokes moment.
Yeah, the way they filmed it, it was just very, you know, blasé almost.
Yeah, but the difference is this one actually deals with that through the remainder of the series. So, like, it actually has far more payoff.
Yeah.
It's kind of that weighing of excitement versus satisfying storytelling.
So, even though it's not this big flashy twist, I have to give it to them, though. Like, this twist works for me because it seems to add even more layers to the character.
Yeah, it does.
And it actually has a lot of implications for what comes next in the character's journey. I give this a warp 9 as well. Like, I think this is a really strong twist for, you know, one Bashir here.
I agree, because this does so much for the character of Bashir, a character who was, like, you know, in the first few seasons, a little adrift, and it finally gave him, like, a real focus and a nice, like, little bit of a step up for maturing the character, so that by the time we got to the end, he really was that seasoned Starfleet officer.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty great one. Okay, well, let's do an Enterprise one. And that is in the episode Doctor's Orders, where they are, you know, the crew is basically going to hibernation because it's a deadly part of space. Phlox is the only one on the ship, or is he? And he has to look after things for 4 days. But T'Pol's there with him, right, Tyler?
I thought so.
So did he. And it turns out that ultimately he's hallucinated T'Pol the whole time.
I know that you've done that in the past. You kept telling me, Jolene Blaylock's here, Tyler. Come visit.
She's my best friend. Yeah, like, this is a twist that it's fun. Like, I think it's a fun twist, but I think it's one people catch on to before the reveal.
Yeah, because a lot of her character stuff, it's like, is that really how T'Pol would act in a situation like this?
A lot of it's very perfunctory, too. Yeah, it's like she's just, like, spouting techno jargon in another room, and you're like, wait a second.
Yeah.
Does this work? But it is one of the few, like, Enterprise episodes that really does try to do the pull out the rug thing.
The thing is, when I rewatch this, though, and I know that it's T'Pol, it's like, it doesn't make the episode that much more interesting, though.
Yeah.
It's just like, and I'm not a fan of the episodes where characters hallucinate, because it seems as if they lose a lot of agency there. If they don't have as much, I guess, will over their actions.
Sure. Kind of like that third Hobbit movie where the character just, like, hallucinates for, like, an hour.
Da?
Yeah.
Da? Or was it Da, or was it the, or was it Richard Armitage?
Richard Armitage. Yeah.
I just want to say Da.
Yeah. But yeah, like, I know what you mean. Like, that sort of thing. If they can trick you initially, you might be invested in what's going on. But if it feels kind of fake, or you can kind of see through the seams, then it becomes really irritating.
That's why maybe I give this one more of a warp 4. It just doesn't work on subsequent viewings for me.
I'm going to give it a 5 for me. And a lot of it has to do with John Billingsley's performance, and that he is selling it really hard. I think the problems with this episode aren't him. It's the fact that, like, the show, you know, the way they're writing the T'Pol character and the way they're directing her doesn't feel like a living, breathing character.
Okay. Well, Ken, why don't we do one more each, and then we have some lightning round that we could do, because, I mean, there's lots to get into here.
Oh, yeah.
But the last one that I do want to highlight here is go back to one Star Trek Discovery again, the Red Angel twist, though.
Yeah, I had that on my list as well.
Because the whole season, we're supposed to wonder the identity about the Red Angel, and we're like, oh.
And there were some wacky theories out there.
A lot of people are convinced it's Deanna Troi.
I heard Picard.
I was like, okay. Ultimately, I mean, were you kept awake at night trying to think of theories about who the Red Angel was? Was it really a mystery that you cared that deeply about?
It's the kind of mystery that is tough, because the thing is, they dangled that in front of us for a lot of episodes over and over again. And it's very tough when you dangle it in front of people to deliver anything that they find exciting or surprising.
So after 14 episodes, we find out that it's actually Burnham this entire time.
We had a bit of the fake out with the Burnham's mom.
Yeah, you know, and I think it was a little bit more than a fake out, because they actually had to, like, explain it away with her DNA.
Yeah.
I was just like, okay, it just seemed very convoluted.
Yeah.
This wasn't a twist that made me, like, my jaw drop.
No.
I'm just like, yeah, I could believe that it's been Burnham this whole time. And guess what? Do I go back and rewatch the season and I have a whole new interpretation of what it all means? Nope. It's just, I happen to know that Burnham's in this Red Angel suit.
Yeah.
Whatever. It doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah, it doesn't add to the enjoyment of the show. I mean, I shouldn't say that, because we haven't actually gone back and done our season 2 rewatch, which we're going to do pretty soon.
Yeah.
It's the sort of thing that just becomes... You know, again, they drag it out too long, like the Voke Ash Tyler twist. It's just, don't keep dangling that in front of people where they're figuring it out. Or I feel like the worst case is maybe with the Red Angel, where people don't even care at a certain point that much.
I mean, what was reaction like on social media, like, about the revelation?
It was very muted when they actually revealed Burnham's mom. Yeah. People were like, oh, okay.
It's some character we've never met before.
Yeah, and did you get any sense of people being enticed by a mystery post Burnham's mom, so that when, you know, there's the reveal of it being Burnham, that anyone really cared by then?
No, because I think maybe a lot of people then were like, well, if it's not Burnham's mom, maybe it's just Burnham.
Yeah.
And then when they reveal that it is Burnham, they're like, okay, well, there you go. It's been Burnham this whole time.
I think our takeaway from this episode is maybe that Discovery needs to work on twists.
Yeah, I think they should just not do them, though. It's like, yeah. The thing is, we're in an age right now where the Reddit detectives can figure everything out by the time the first seed is planted.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happens when you have the audience kind of ahead of the rest of the characters for weeks on end. It just really drags, you know? And it's just like, and the thing is, I look at like all the great TV series that are out there. They don't rely on twists. Like, there weren't a lot of twists in Sopranos or Mad Men or like The Wire or Deadwood or anything like that. And there's really only like one twist ever in like Breaking Bad. I don't want to really spoil it, but I mean, there's been a lot of reveals in all those shows.
Oh, yeah.
But not twists. And those shows never really needed twists for you to be invested in what's going on, you know? So I just say Star Trek, unless you got something really awesome, or if you're doing a Course of Oblivion where it's all contained within like a 45 minutes episode, like, go for it, you know? But otherwise, just, guys, it's not going to be worth it. You can't do it well in this modern age of TV anymore. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm of the same opinion. I was going to mention Course of Oblivion as well, and that come up with a really great episode twist, but dragging it out for like 8 episodes or 9 episodes is just not a good idea.
Yeah.
Especially when you don't have something that's gangbusters to deliver.
Yeah. So to me, this isn't like Ash Tyler level. I give it a warp 4, I guess.
It's entirely inoffensive.
Yeah.
Like, it's not one that you really struggle with. You go, yes, that makes logical sense, which is something you wouldn't say with the Lorca one. This one tracks. It's just entirely uninteresting when they reveal it. So I guess like a 4 for me, I guess. It does what it's sort of supposed to do narratively. It just doesn't surprise you. So it's kind of a bit of a yawn.
Yeah.
But I want to do one that's a little bit of a compare contrast, just to kind of put two together. And that is the reveals of the villains of Khan and Krall in the two JJ or the Kelvinverse movies, where you have both of these characters being given, these villains being given a plot twist. You know, obviously the Khan one, it's been John Harrison the whole time. We found out it's Khan. And in Beyond, Krall, we think, is some sort of alien the whole time. And then we find out it's Edison, who is a Starfleet member.
So, Cam, remember the lead up into Star Trek Into Darkness? And I kept telling you, well, you know, I know JJ and I know Damon Lindelof, they like to do a lot of red herrings. Yeah. I know they're really seeming to telegraph that it's all about Khan. It's not going to be Khan. When I found out it was Khan, I was like, really?
Yeah.
Because it really does not add anything to this character. And if anything, it kind of makes it a less interesting character just for the reasons they bring him back. Like, to build weapons?
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah.
Okay. And also, it's kind of like whitewashing Hollywood yet again.
Yeah.
It's like, this is a South Asian man.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay.
And it doesn't do anything to really deepen our interest in the character of Khan. It doesn't add new layers. And the themes of that movie are a little muddied already, where it's all about what Kirk would do for his crew. And they tie that onto the Khan character. And I don't think that is something that really works with that particular character.
Yeah.
I think that's something that works a lot better with Krall, a guy who has basically lost his mind because of losing his crew. Like, that is a character that thematically, it makes a lot more sense having the Krall Kirk parallel than the Khan Kirk parallel.
I give this a warp 3 for me personally.
The Khan one?
Yeah. Maybe give your grade and then we can go into the Krall one, because I think maybe we can have a good discussion about Krall.
I think I'm going to go a 1 on Khan.
Okay.
Because to me, it's a twist the entire audience sees, well, anyone who knows Star Trek sees coming for the large part.
Yeah.
And it's a twist that is revealed on screen entirely for the audience, not for the characters.
Yeah.
Because it means nothing to Kirk.
I am Khan.
Yeah.
Chris Pine gives a blank face.
Who? He's like, I am Kirk.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, like, the payoff of it is not that interesting either in terms of giving us anything on the character of Khan. Whereas, you know, with the Edison one, what did you think?
I thought a boring alien played by a great actor who's just caked in makeup, so you can't really get him to do as much acting as you'd hope. But I was just like, oh, wait a minute. I understand his motivations now. I mean, it's not particularly like super, super interesting motivations,
right?
You know, but it's like a career soldier who wants to fight, fight, fight. And I actually thought it actually gave me a different way to interpret the character when I went back and watched it again. And I actually thought that it was a twist that works, which doesn't always work out for Star Trek, especially in this era. Never saw it coming. I don't think anybody was speculating on this before the movie came out. this is a twist that worked, you know?
Yeah. And I like that it informs Kirk's journey in a way that feels like organic to the character, as opposed to, you know, more like the Into Darkness, which is really just like hammered and chiseled together.
Yeah.
You know, like, we have to have an arc for Kirk. How do we somehow tie this to a popular villain we can market? Although not really market.
Wow. Yeah. Also, I just like how it made Uhura seem like really smart and competent at her job, because like, she's so good at like communications, hearing things, that she was able to recognize this like tinge of a familiar voice here.
Yeah.
And she was reviewing the video and she's like, wait a minute, that captain, that's Krall. What the hell's going on here? Like, that to me, like, I like it when our characters get to be smart.
Also, anytime you can have a twist where I can go to a movie and hear a character say, I fought the Zindi.
It's the first and last time we ever get that, though. I'm sorry.
That was one of the most incredible movies I've ever had in a movie theater. Just like, did I just hear that?
For me, I give this a warp 8. Like, this is a good one. This is very good.
This is very good. This is like A Course of Oblivion. It's just a perfectly written and implemented twist.
And look, you don't have to be a Star Trek geek to know it. It works for general audiences, too. I dig.
Yeah.
So, Ken, maybe lightning round. I'll go through a couple. You go through a couple.
Sure.
Picard equals Shinzon. Shinzon equals Picard. It's, you know, his DNA. Like, it was maybe obvious to us going in. We kind of knew the twist of it all. But
it's funny, though. Like, I was not a Star Trek viewer when this movie came out. I'd seen the movies, and I was going to see this one in theaters with my buddy, Gabe, who was a Star Trek fan. But I remember knowing that he was Picard, even though I was not someone who was following Star Trek information before the movie came out. Like, they really,
it was all in the marketing.
Yeah, they really
way to
hammer that home. Yeah.
Tom Riker is actually taking over Will's identity in the episode Defiant. The best moment that came out of that was when Miles came by and wanted to make small talk with Will, and Will told him to F off pretty much, and says he knows what he did. And then as a viewer at the time, I was just like, ooh, what happened? What happened?
Yes.
You know, I thought that was like one of my favorite moments from like a pretty solid episode as well.
Yeah.
So, those are the kind of the two I wanted to get out of the way. And I guess maybe the other one, though, is kind of a traveler twist, though. And like, his first appearance in Where No Man Has Gone Before, we're made to believe is like Kaczynski was like the real brains behind this operation. But it is, in fact, the traveler the whole time here.
Right.
So I had to get in one additional traveler name drop before we wrap up.
I'm down with it.
But do you have a couple that you just wanted to get out there?
Yeah. So,
and don't, I already mentioned the dog is a villain in Aquiel, so don't worry about that.
I just had that written down multiple times. Yeah. TNG, you have the conspiracy story with the worm people being revealed inside of key Starfleet members. Boy, that could have gone somewhere interesting.
But
didn't.
That's what Star Trek Picard is all about now.
It just gave us at the time Star Trek's like goriest moment of all time, which really did last up until Discovery, I guess.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah. You also have Replicant O'Brien in the episode Whispers.
Oh yeah, I like that.
DS9.
That was solid.
It really works because you have the entire time this the sympathetic O'Brien character that we feel frustrated for.
Yeah.
And then they turn it on us.
Yeah.
This is a really well done one. and then lastly, I think this is a really show stopping one to go out on. In,
I can sense the sarcasm oozing out of your mouth right now. But,
in the Enterprise story, 2 days and two nights, Archer meets a lovely woman who's revealed to be a Tandaren undercover, wanting to investigate him and find out about the Suliban.
Yeah. But it's like, we have, I thought you were going to talk about like Reed and Trip.
Oh no, that wasn't what I was going to mention.
Oh, I thought it's like they thought they were hooking up with women, and it turned out to be dudes.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
It's like that doesn't really work nowadays in modern TV. Where like almost transphobic to a certain degree, and just like, I thought that's where you were going.
No, I was going with the Archer one because I feel like that was at one point in time in Inception something that they wanted to make a plot element. And it never pays off in any way, shape, or form. Yeah. But it's there, folks.
There you go.
Okay. So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Did we miss any key twists? We want you to tell us what they were. Okay, Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Yeah, I think we are going to do the evolution of the Vulcans. We've done the evolution of everything from the Klingons to androids, Cardassians, what have you. finally, time to get to the Vulcans. We're going to really kind of talk about the big, big moments that have helped us, I guess, really get our heads around one of the most iconic species in all of Star Trek.
Spock's brain.
Spock's brain. But we're going to be tackling episodes from every single series because I think they're just quite ubiquitous throughout all of Star Trek and maybe featured more in some series than others. But, Cam, this is going to be a fun one because there's just so much to pick through. And I think it is also going to give us some room to see where the Vulcans can go in their journey going forward.
Right. Okay, so you can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in villainous dog in Aquiel Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T. T as in Tom Riker Shames O'Brien. O-N.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.